Hello and welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 92.7 FM Hood River and the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in Corvallis and the Willamette Valley, and KBOO.com on the World Wide Web. I'm here with co-host Bill Byers. Today we're going to be talking with Jessica Goodell, who has written Shaded Black, Death and After in Iraq. It's a story of her time with the Marine Corps in mortuary affairs and about her time there and her life back here in the States. But first, I want to have a few announcements before we get going. Bill and I want to thank Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 for awarding the two of us a certificate of excellence for our 20 years on Veterans Voice Radio Show, dealing with veterans issues here on KBOO Radio. And we want to really thank those guys for doing that.
Yes, very much appreciated.
Yes, it was wonderful. I'm going to be gone until December. Laurel and I, we're going to Vietnam for 3 months. Laurel's going to be teaching at universities in Ho Chi Minh City, Hue, and Hanoi. And I'm going to be traveling and interviewing folks about their part in what the Vietnamese call the American War. And I'm really looking forward to talking with the women who were members of the National Front for the Liberation of Vietnam, and they were also called Viet Cong. And they also fought against the South Vietnamese and the American armies. Tammy and Kate and I have put together three shows that they'll play while I'm gone. Two older shows, Women on War, hosted by Carolyn Mills. And then that's in celebration of our 20 years here on KBOO. And the third show will be with Don Blackburn, our friend Don Blackburn. He's a Vietnam veteran, and he has written a book of poetry titled All You Have Given, Meditations on War, Peace, and Reconciliation. And it's a very, very good book, and Don's a good friend. He lives a lot. About half his time or more now in Vietnam. He works with the children in Vietnam. I don't know how many kids he's put through school over there just helping them out. And he travels there a lot. And so now let's talk with our guest, Jessica. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
It's really nice to hear you. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
We're doing good. My co-host is Bill. He's a Korean vet.
Good morning.
And he's an atomic veteran. And your book, I put the word out that we were going to be talking with you, and I got a lot of feedback on it. People really interested in hearing your story. I got an email from Bud Brown down in Monmouth. He's a professor down at Western Oregon University, and he got me. For some reason, I keep saying color it black, you know, and I'll be looking right at your book, and I've been read it and everything, and for some reason, I keep saying color it black, and I'm really sorry, and he got me for that, and he said to tell you to check your email. So I don't know.
Okay.
He must have sent you something, and he said he told me to ask you to please check your email. So when did you were in the Marine Corps?
Yes.
How was you, was there any members of your family had been in the Marines? Is that why you went in the Marines?
No one in my family was in the Marine Corps. I think it just happened by happenstance that it was the Marine Corps that I went into.
And that was for 4 years? Were you in for 4 years?
Yep, I was in from 2001 to 2005.
Mm-hmm. I know the story, when you enlisted, you didn't enlist for the mortuary affairs. You enlisted for something else. And
right.
what was that?
I initially enlisted to be a diesel mechanic,
mm-hmm.
and so that's what I was. That was my MOS. And then when Mortuary Affairs came about, Mortuary Affairs was a volunteer-only platoon that they put together. So it was a collection of Marines from all different MOSs.
So you had to volunteer. To do that, you had to volunteer.
Yes.
And Iraq, was that your first duty station?
No, my first duty station was Okinawa, Japan. Mm-hmm. And I was there for 2 years. And then when I came stateside, I came to 29 Palms in California. And the platoon that I had entered into had just gotten back from that initial invasion of March 2003. And I felt a lot of pressure, both from the other Marines and from myself, that in order to be a real Marine, mm-hmm. I needed to go to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I ended up volunteering for Mortuary Affairs.
So the Mortuary Affairs, in the military, in the Army, we called it grave registrations, and that was a job that I don't think very many people would want to do. And for you to do that job, did you know what you were getting into when you volunteered for that? Did you know exactly what you'd be doing?
You know, I just knew that I wanted to go to Iraq. Like I said, I felt that, you know, I wanted to be a real Marine. And so when the platoon sergeant said, he came to our platoon and said that they were sending Marines back over for another wave, and that if we wanted to go over, we'd have to volunteer for something because they already had all the mechanics that they needed. So the first position that he said was, you know, we need Marines for the Mortuary Affairs platoon. So my hand just shot in the air. You know, he could have said anything, and my hand, you know, I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really didn't, I really didn't know what I was getting into. And my only kind of warning came from a couple Marines who said, oh, you know, Goodell, that's going to be tough. But it didn't sink in. It didn't occur to me.
Yeah.
And before we went over, we had several weeks of training.
Yeah, talk about that. You know, I was in your book. I was really interested in that. Could you talk about how your training was and where you did your training and what your training was?
Sure. The Mortuary Affairs Platoon, all of the Marines gathered at Camp Pendleton. We had Marines who were previously cooks, supply, admin, MVC, motor T drivers, and we all gathered at Camp Pendleton, where we trained for a couple of weeks before we ended up going over. The training consisted of going over the paperwork that we were to fill out for each remains that we collected. And so some of those sheets were, one of them was an inventory list, where we would write down everything that came in on the body, every piece of the uniform that was on the body, any pieces of gear, everything that was in their wallet, everything that was in their pockets. We'd write everything down in an effort to make sure that everything that this Marine came in with would make it back to their home. There was one sheet. Another sheet was a diagram that was an outline of a body, and we were instructed to document any identifying marks on the diagram. So any tattoos, any scars. We also documented wounds that had been on the remains. And then the title of the book, Shade It Black, came from this diagram literally, in that if pieces of the remains were missing, we were to shade in that area on the diagram black.
Wow.
Another thing that they taught us to do was how to collect the remains. So what they did was they actually took raw meat and scattered it in this grassy area, and then they taught us how to flag all the remains to make sure that we could collect every piece.
Wow. Wow, and that was a two-week course.
Right, it was a couple weeks long.
And then did you go home before you went to Iraq?
No.
You went straight from Pendleton.
Right, yep. We were just waiting for the word. And when the word came, we had 24 hours. So we were already packed and ready and waiting to go when that came in.
How many people were in your platoon?
We had, we went out initially with 18 Marines.
18 Marines. How many women?
It was just me and another woman, so two.
Two women. And, geez, two women. Bill has some.
Yeah, were you replacing a group that had been there already?
There was the Army that was out there. What had happened, at least in the beginning of OIF, from my experiences, the Marines went out, and then the Army came and replaced the Marines. And then the Marines went out and replaced the Army.
Okay.
So there was actually an Army, some Army personnel that that we were replacing.
That you were.
I see.
That's interesting. Who you? Your company commander now. That was an interesting story. Could you talk a little bit about him? The warrant officer.
Well,
was he? He was a warrant officer, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a chief warrant officer.
Mm-hmm.
He was in charge of us. And now looking back on it, I think that he was really young. But at the time, he was an old man. and he was the best officer that I ever had. He was very hardworking. He was very dedicated. He was very protective of us. He was very wise. And he really had the interests of the Mortuary Affairs Platoon as priority one.
Right. So when you got on the airplane and you landed in Iraq, where did you land?
We actually flew from California to Maryland, then over to Germany, and then we flew into Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
And we waited in Kuwait for a couple weeks, waiting for all of the gear, all of the vehicles to arrive in Kuwait. Then once all of the vehicles and all the trucks and the tanks and everything got to Kuwait, we were put into a long convoy.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we convoyed north for several days into Iraq.
And so when you finally got to Iraq, where was your base located? Where was your base located, and what did your... what did the mortuary building, I guess, what did it look like?
Our platoon was stationed at Camp Takadum, Iraq, which is west of Baghdad.
Okay.
And then when we got there, the Mortuary Affairs Platoon was given an entire bunker.
Wow.
And this bunker, Camp Takadum was an old airfield, and so the bunker, I think that the bunker was actually originally designed to hold airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a large hangar looking like structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely empty. And so we actually built tables, and we built a door, and we built a duty hut, and we built several rooms in the bunker. And then we also ran the electrical lights, which mostly consisted of running, the lights along the walls.
Right.
And then we had to hook up the ACs and the reefers. Mortuary Affairs had, we were given two reefers so that we could refrigerate the remains before mm-hmm. they were shipped home, because we didn't often know when a plane would be leaving that could take off, and so we might be holding on to the remains, and so we had the reefers for that.
You refer to them as reefers. Could you describe them, please?
Yeah, refrigerators.
Oh, sure.
Were they refrigerators?
Right. So they were, we had two very large containers, one of the reefers was actually, it was like the back of a semi.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, very large. And then we cooled it down with an AC. And then the other reefer was smaller, you know, maybe like 20 feet square.
Mm-hmm.
And then that smaller reefer went on the back of one of our 7-tons so that we could take it with us when we went on convoys.
Okay. And that also, would that refrigerator would go with you when you went out to pick up remains?
Right. Because often when we would go on a convoy to pick up remains, we never knew how long we would be gone for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it might be a day trip, it might be 2 days, it might be 3 days. And so when we got to a site, we would put the remains into the reefer to bring them back to the bunker.
Do you carry your own generator with you to supply power?
Probably.
Yeah, we would bring small generators with us and put them back in the back of the 7-ton.
Uh-huh.
And also, the reefer itself was kept cold all the time,
mm-hmm.
and so it actually stayed cold.
Okay,
I see.
For
okay,
convoys.
Yeah.
When Jessica, I know it's hard, you know, to talk about all this, and I'm really glad that you know you wrote the book, and so people can understand, but. Could you tell us about the first time that you had to go out and retrieve a body?
I remember the first convoy. So our mission would always start with a phone call. The phone would ring, and the other person on the end of the line would say, you know, we have a Marine down. Or, you know, we're in a firefight, you know, soldiers are down. And so we would set up to go on a convoy, getting all the vehicles ready, mounting the weapons. Often we'd have the MPs, the military police, mm-hmm. come with us. Sometimes EOD had to come with us. They're the Marines that work with explosives. And so we'd go on a convoy out to the site. And I remember the first one I went on.
Okay.
I had pulled off on the side of the road. We had gotten to the site, and everyone was getting out of the vehicles, you know, grabbing gloves and grabbing body bags. And I walked around my vehicle, and there in the road was a small crater looking like a large pothole. And I looked into it, and there in the pothole was a boot. With the foot still in it. And so I knew right away, you know, this was like something I had never experienced before. The site that we had gone to was actually where the Army had been going on a convoy, and they had been crossing a bridge. And an IED exploded over the bridge, and it shot a 7-ton just straight up into the air, and the 7-ton fell over the bridge and into a ravine. So when we got there, we hiked down into this ravine. It was a sandy bank. And the 7-ton was at the bottom. It had been burning. It had exploded. But by the time we were there and they called us in, the fire had already been put out. And there was an Army soldier that was inside that we pulled out. So that was, you know, the first,
mm-hmm.
the first convoy.
Yeah, that's pretty tough. So when you would take the bodies out of the truck, and then what did you have to do? Did you? I don't know. What you did after you got bodies out.
Okay, the truck had been flipped upside down, and me and another Marine were actually down in the truck, crawling into the truck, pulling out pieces. And we pulled out every single piece that was in that truck of the soldier. We were able to pull out. And what we would do is we would take the remains and then put them into a body bag.
Mm-hmm.
Then we took the body bags and we went up the ravine. And we loaded the body bags into our vehicles. From there, we convoyed back to base. And then once we were at the bunker, that's when we would start to process the remains.
Mm-hmm. That's when you... Go ahead, Jessica.
And so that's when we would open up the body bags and sort remains. So, for example, if there were multiple people, you know, trying to put put the remains into coherent holes so that each body would go to the respective family. And then what would happen is that we would then put the remains into the reefer.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we knew when a plane would leave, we would take the body bag out of the reefer, put the body bag into an aluminum transfer case, those are the like metal coffins.
Right, the metal coffins. Mm-hmm.
Then we would put the flag over it, tie down the flag with 550 cord, and take the remains to the airfield,
mm-hmm.
and then put it on a plane and go down its way.
They'd send them home. Bill had something he wanted to ask.
Yeah,
him.
When you went out to gather the remains, how many would you pick up at one time on average? Can you tell me that?
Sure. It varied. Every call was different.
I'm sure it was. Yeah. Was there any? Do you have a ballpark figure?
Sometimes it could be 2 Marines. It could be 4 Marines. It could be anywhere up to 8 Marines.
You picked up Marines only?
No, we picked up anyone. So we picked up. We had Marines. We had Army. We processed some airmen, and we would also process Iraqis as well.
So, wow. Okay, go ahead, Jessica. Sorry.
Sometimes there might be people who had died, and because of the nature of the scene, it being unstable, or there might be, people with their weapons still hanging out at the scene, we would collect all of the remains.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would put up notices in the villages saying that we have an Iraqi. If anyone can claim him or her, they can come to our base and we could give them the Iraqi body as well.
Did that happen
a
lot?
That happened. It happened a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And the Iraqis would come onto our base and we would give them the remains of their loved one.
Wow, that's interesting. So what did the other Marines, not in the mortuary affairs, but what did the other Marines, how did they deal with you guys? How did they treat you folks from the mortuary affairs?
I think it must have been difficult for other Marines to interact with us. Now, the male Marines in the Mortuary Affairs Platoon, they actually live separate from the general population.
Oh.
Most Marines on base lived in what was called Tent City.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the females, myself and the other female Marine, we stayed in a tent that had other female Marines in it from other jobs. And it seemed as though it was hard for us to interact with other Marines and for other Marines to interact with us. And so what we would do as a platoon, I mean, we were a very close-knit platoon, and it must have been hard for other Marines to interact with us because, they have to wake up in the morning and go on their convoys and do their jobs, and we represent a real possibility of what could happen.
Yeah. You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And we're talking with Jessica Goodell, author of Shaded Black, Death and After in Iraq. And she's been talking about her experiences at the mortuary affairs platoon in Iraq. Jessica, how many people lasted? I mean, you said there was 18 of you went over in your platoon, 18 people, which isn't a lot, but how many of them made it? How many of them stuck it out through the whole tour? Because that's a stressful job.
Yeah. We had Marines. There was a point in time where we just kept, there was a flow of remains into the mortuary affairs bunker. And so we needed help. And so what we had done is we had trained other Marines, and other Marines had volunteered to be in the mortuary affairs platoon while we were in Iraq. And so we would train them. And as far as I know, no one ever ended up staying with us.
Wow.
So we had several Marines come in and leave. Now, to their credit, you know, we all went out together, and we all trained together, you know, whereas they were coming in halfway through, or, you know, we were a new platoon for them. So I'm sure that that added to the difficulty of it for them. But the 18 that we went out with, we had two Marines in that platoon who ended up going home at an earlier date.
Wow.
But for the most part,
most part they stayed. Do you think that they left because of the psychological and emotional problems of dealing with the grave registrations?
I'm sure that played played the part because, you know, when you're in the Marine Corps, you have an assignment. You know, you have a job that you have to do. And working in mortuary affairs, it isn't as though we're processing strangers.
Right.
You know, the Marines that we're processing, they look like us in that they're wearing the same uniform as us. You know, they have the same trousers, the same belt, the same watch, you know, the same wallet. And so it reminds you, you know, that your own death is a very real possibility. And it really gets you thinking, questions,
mm-hmm.
and the hard questions, you know. So so I'm sure that's what made it very difficult for
the Marines. Bill had a question he wanted to ask.
Yes, Jessica, how many female soldier service people were in the, where you were stationed, and did you intermix with them and establish any sort of camaraderie?
Yeah, with the women in the tent that you lived in. How many women were in that tent, and how did the two of you interact with those women?
In Tent City where we lived, I think that there was about 4 or 5 tents that were female tents. All of the rest were male tents. And in each female tent, once we were settled and we each had our tents, we had about 10 to 12 people in our tent, 10 to 12 females. So there wasn't many females on the entire base at all at that point. Now, it was really difficult for me to interact with the other females. A lot of the females had, you know, were married or had children back home. And, you know, they have a job to do,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I'm sure that they were already worried about not coming home to their children or not coming home to their spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure that kind of added to the barrier between us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one female in my tent, who I'm still friends with now, who kept trying to talk to me while I was there. So I might be at the bunker processing remains for 2 or 3 days and finally come home and it's, or come to the tent and it's 4 in the morning and she would have written a note and left it on my cot that said, you know, wake me up so we can talk when you get home.
Mm-hmm.
And talking for me at that point was the last thing that I wanted to do.
Right.
I didn't want to talk about what I was doing. I didn't want to talk about what I was seeing. And so there was a lot of withdrawal on my part as well.
Right. So how long was your tour in Iraq in Mortuary Affairs?
We were out there for 8 months.
8 months. And then when your time was up, another group came and took your place, and you came back to the States.
Yes. Yep.
Somebody asked me in the hallway here when they knew about what your job was there, and they wanted for me to ask you what did you think about the bodies coming home from Delaware to Dover, Delaware, and the government not letting the American people see our fallen troops, not being able to take pictures of them. What did you think? What did you think about that?
That's a really hard, hard topic. Mm-hmm. Because in one sense, these are just my personal feelings.
Yeah.
Just based on my own experience. While we're out there, I didn't really realize this until I came out of the Marine Corps and I'm transitioning into civilian lifestyle, how my peers in the civilian world seem to be unaware, because this war, it just seems so abstract, it just seems so far away. And so I think that not showing the coffins really detaches Americans from the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like the American people weren't even knowing there was really a war going on at that time. So when you came back from your tour of duty, how much time did you have left in the Marine Corps?
I had I probably had another 8 months to mm-hmm. go. I didn't end up getting out until August of 2005.
Okay, when you came back, did you and your fellow Marines that were in Mortuary Affairs, did you get any kind of counseling for PTSD?
When we were in Iraq, it was mandatory. Our whole platoon went into a counseling center while we were in Iraq. And what they did, they had us fill out questionnaires on an electronic stylus device, like a
mm-hmm.
PDA.
Mm-hmm.
Once we filled that out, we were called individually, each of us, into an office where they would ask us questions. And the questions that they asked me, the first question that they asked me was, how is your libido?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I said,
Really?
What? I'm in Iraq right now. I'm doing Mortuary Affairs right now. I said, maybe you could ask me when I get back home and things are more normal. The next question they said was, how are you eating? And I said, the trucks that carry the food to our base keep getting hit. They kept getting blown up. And slowly we kept getting weaned down on our meals. We usually had 4 meal times, then it went down to 3, then it went down to 2. And so I told them, I'm down to 1 meal a day right now, so my eating isn't that great, and I work in Mortuary Affairs.
There you go.
And then the next question was, how are your sleeping patterns? I go on, I process, and when we process for days. And so I often go 3 or 4 days without sleep. And then on top of that, I work in Mortuary Affairs. So when I get home to my tent, it's not easy for me to sleep,
Mm-hmm.
And so they recommended that I see someone else. And the same thing happened when I saw another counselor. They recommended that I speak to someone else. And that mm-hmm. was it.
That was it. So you got back to the States, and you went to your new duty station. What was that duty station? What did you do there?
There I went back to my home platoon, which was at 29 Palms.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was back to being a mechanic again.
Mm-hmm. How did you interact with you with your brothers and sisters Marines at that time? How did they look at you, and how did you feel towards them?
Well, that platoon that I went back into, you know, they had already been to Iraq. Most of them had already been to Iraq. And so when I came back from Iraq myself, we didn't talk about it. There was no, you know, we didn't discuss it. It was, they had already been to Iraq, I had been to Iraq, we already knew what it was like. I did try and bring it up to one of the Marines, and the response that I got was that because I wasn't there for their, that initial invasion of March 2003, that I didn't really know what war was like.
See, I wanted I want to talk to you about that. Go ahead.
And so he had told me that, you know, I had no place to complain. Now as a Marine, I've been trained not to complain. And so when he said that, I took that to heart. And so I just didn't talk about it. I didn't talk about it to any of the Marines, what I had done or what I had seen. It was just back to being a mechanic.
Right, and then you were discharged. Did you get any psychological counseling when you got back to California?
No.
None?
You know, I didn't really think that anything was any different with me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that, I didn't notice anything different.
Okay.
It wasn't until several years later, when I was looking at my life and realizing that, you know, it was difficult for me to leave my house, that I was struggling with substance abuse,
mm-hmm.
That I didn't have any friends, that I wasn't really close to my family. You know, it took a long time for that to build up and then for me to realize it.
Right. So you got involved with another Marine who had been in the initial invasion in Iraq, who, from what I read in your book, he had flaming PTSD. And then you, with your PTSD, in that relationship, that must have been a really hard, hard relationship for you to deal with.
Yeah. It was difficult. And just as it was difficult for me, I'm sure it was just as difficult for him as
mm-hmm.
well. You know, because we're trained to be tough and to not complain and to, you know, not talk about our feelings as Marines. And then when you get out and you think something is, you know, amiss, it's really difficult to acknowledge that and then talk about it.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that really interested me in your book was when the two of you were traveling through Arizona or one of those states, and you got into an argument, and he dumped you out of his car, and you were there by yourself in the desert, I think, if I remember right. How that had to be just a flashback to Iraq.
I think we both were really just in a place where we were both hurting each other, you know,
mm-hmm.
psychologically, emotionally,
mm-hmm.
and it was hard for us to part ways because we were both Marines,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's that, you know, that understanding, that camaraderie, that instant understanding of each other, and so even though it was difficult for both of us, we ended up staying together for much longer than was healthy.
Yeah. You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, and we're talking with Jessica Goodell, author of Shaded Black, Death and After in Iraq, about her tour as a Marine at Mortuary Affairs. And we've gone through what she did in Iraq, and now we're talking about her life after she's returned. And Bill had a question, Jessica, he'd like to ask.
Yeah, Jessica. The the platoon that you refer to, you trained as a unit, as a group, and you were familiar with one another and relied on one another and trusted one another, and you went to Iraq as a unit?
Yes.
And when you came back, did you come back as a unit?
Yes. We did come back as a unit, but because we had all come from different MOSs and different bases, we were only together, I think that it was only for a couple days before we had to go back to our home units. So we ended up not staying together, you know, once we got back.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. And so after you and your boyfriend had separated, were you getting any kind of counseling? Did you go to the vet center, or did you do... Because you had a real problem with alcohol abuse, I know, which is part of PTSD, and you hunkered down, you stayed away from people. When did it come to the point where you knew you had to go get help?
It really dawned on me. I had been in my apartment for a long time, and... it was hard for me to get out to go get groceries. And when I would go get groceries, it was so anxiety-provoking for mm-hmm. me. And I wasn't answering my phone. I hadn't spoken to my family. And so I thought, you know, I wonder what a counseling center could offer me. You know, I was completely oblivious to the weight of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I did end up going into a counseling. I went into the VA.
Right. Good for you.
And when I went to the VA, you know, they do a bunch of tests, and you fill out a bunch of questionnaires, and then you speak to a counselor. And that's when I was diagnosed with PTSD, mm-hmm. generalized anxiety disorder,
mm-hmm.
major depression,
mm-hmm.
and substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. So how did you, okay, you've done that, and which is good, I'm sure you're still on your medications because it takes a long time and you never really get over PTSD. Are you now in a good relationship? Are you in a relationship now that are not? I mean, that's kind of personal, but we've all been through that.
Now I'm in a much healthier place.
Good for you. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to school. I'm actually going to graduate school this fall.
Wow.
And what I've been doing that's really helped me out is I've been doing a lot of reading.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot of Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
And doing a lot of reflecting on... the role that I played, my participation, the beliefs that I had about it. And what's really fortunate for my generation is the use of the Internet. And so because of the Internet, I'm able to stay in contact with the Marines of Mortuary Affairs.
Oh, good for you.
So that's been extremely helpful, communicating with them. So.
Wow. Bill had a question you wanted to ask.
Yeah, Jessica. Are you a religious person, and if you are, or if you are not, how did that play into your experiences?
I was raised in a Christian household where every Sunday we went to church. There was no question. You know, that's what we did on Sunday mornings. That was difficult for me then to go to Iraq, you know, because that brought up a lot of contradictory ideas and beliefs with my religion and what I was doing. And so I've really been trying to form congruent beliefs.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. go ahead.
And, you know, if beliefs don't line up, something is askew.
There you go.
And so trying not So trying to address those issues, you know, and solidifying my coherent system has been really helpful.
Yeah, good for you. I noticed on the back of your book it had further readings, and I went through and looked down through this list here, and I've read them all, the ones you got here. Oh. I've been through, I've read them all. But the one book that caught my eye, and I'd like to know how come you picked this book. It's Chris Hedges' book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. How did you pick that book? Why?
Well, I was in my undergraduate courses, and I had told one of my professors that I was struggling with Iraq. And the book that he recommended to me was that book, Chris Hedges' War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And so I read it, and reading that book, I felt, you know, it connected me to a wider realm, that war, it's not just Americans and Iraqis, it's not just Americans and Afghanis, it's all, it happens a lot in the world, and knowing that other people are struggling with the issues that I'm struggling with, you know, and that other people are trying to find meaning in the midst of this chaos and this war, it really helped me feel that I wasn't alone.
Right. You're not alone. I guarantee you. You're not alone.
That's a wonderful book.
That is a wonderful book. And what was your undergraduate degree, and what is your graduate work going to be in?
I got my bachelor's degree from SUNY Fredonia. That's a small school in Western New York. And this fall, I'm going to the University of Buffalo, where I'm working on my PhD in counseling psychology.
Ah, good one. That's a good one. I think you're going to do just fine there. We don't have much time left, and I know I wish we had more time because I've got so many questions, and I wanted to open the phone lines and everything, but it's so important for people to listen to you. Were any of your female troopers, were they ever, when you were in Iraq or even when you're back, were you women ever sexually harassed?
I was not. I was in a wonderful platoon. I was really fortunate to be with the Marines that I was over there with. However, I do know that sexual harassment is and does occur. And certainly, I have put up with my share of harassment while I was in Iraq, not from the Mortuary Affairs Marines, but from other Marines. And that kind of adds to the weight that you carry when you're in Iraq. You know, if I go to the gym, you know, what's going to happen to me when I'm at the gym? You know, if I have to go take a shower, what's going to happen to me while I go to take a shower? You know, even if it's just the name calling and the looks, not to mention the words that come out of people's mouths.
Yeah.
As a female, I didn't feel any alleviation from that at all, except when I was with my own platoon.
Right. Good. That's good. So you said you were in contact with other folks, that the internet helped you get in contact with other folks that you had served with. Are they having problems? Did they go through problems too? Emotional problems?
I would say yes. I know that there's several of us who are still struggling with this. I'm still struggling with it.
Yes, you
as well. But I think, thank goodness for the internet, because as those others are struggling, we can at least send them emails. You know, we can at least send them messages, which has helped me tremendously.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel the same way that talking to people that you served with in a war zone. I was in Vietnam in '68, and I just, like last year, got in touch with some guys I've served with on Facebook that you know, and that is so, you know, very helpful, very, because they help you, you know, straighten things out. So are you going to Are you going to go into private practice when you get done?
I'm not sure to what capacity I'm going to be working with veterans. I know that I want to work with veterans, but I'm not quite sure in which area to go into. So what I've been doing thus far is that I know that my research will be on veterans and PTSD. And so I've actually, a couple weeks ago, was able to interview a Vietnam veteran who did mortuary affairs in Vietnam.
Wow.
And
amazing.
I was the first mortuary affairs person that he's seen since Vietnam.
Wow. That's great.
Jessica, yeah, so the healing that happens, you know, is unbelievable.
Yeah. Jessica, we've run out of time, and I want to thank you so much for coming on our show and talking to our listeners about what happened to you and how you're dealing, and it sounds like you're going to be okay, and that your book is a wonderful book, and I hope that folks here will get a copy of it. It's called Shade It Black, Death and After in Iraq, and it's by Jessica Goodell. Jessica, I want to really thank you for coming on our show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thanks, Jess. We'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening to KBOO Veterans Voice at 90.7 FM. I'll be, like I said, I'm going to Vietnam for 3 months, and Tammy and Kate and I put together three shows that they'll play. Tammy's the boss. She'll be the boss for the next 3 months, and she'll start the show and finish the show for us. And you can hear some of our earlier shows on KBOO by going to www.kboo.fm/veteransvoice. And we want to thank KBOO listeners for the last 20 wonderful years here on Veterans Voice and on KBOO. Bill, you got something you want to say before we leave?
This installation, the KBOO, is a wonderful, wonderful. I've been in and out of it for a number of years, and I don't see how the city could do without it.
Nope, I don't either. Tammy, I'll see you in 3 months, and you're the boss when we're gone. So thank you, KBOO listeners.
Okay, Marvin.
And I'll see you on December, I think it's the 19th. We'll have a new show, and Bill and I will be back. And thanks, KBOO. Goodbye.